Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Leyte Su, host of Word of Mouth. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Zorn, the food editor at Northside Media, which produces the annual Taste Talks Festival in both Brooklyn and Chicago each fall. Picking up where the festival left off, the Taste Talks podcast brings innovators from various fields, including music, art, media, design, and tech, together with luminaries from the food and restaurant world to expound on any and all topics related to taste. Being an actor turned food writer, I admit it, today's show is very close to my heart, as we'll be talking with two actors turned chefs, Shane Lyons of Distilled and Daniel Eddy of Rebel, to explore the surprising but seemingly very real creative connection between the two. Running with that, we'll examine the theater of food at the end of the show by spotlighting restaurants that are all about bringing the drama to your plate. But first, I'll be joined in the studio by Gothamist food editor Nell Casey, who I only just learned, really, this is sheer coincidence, is also an actor turned food writer to talk about the week's breaking culinary news. Oh, God, Nell, are you so deeply in debt as I am?
Of course. I mean, it's yeah. I mean, I love that we're exploring this because, again, we had that conversation just out of the blue about how you were putting together this show. And I was like, well, wouldn't you know it?
I know. Well, we will converse about this in depth in a second. But listen, it is newly officially summer, adieu to ramps and all that, which is why we have been tracking a few stories that really seem to personify the season, right? So there's one that I have been following with particular vested interest. It's a bill that has made its way all the way through the Senate, has been passed by the Assembly, and is currently waiting for a yay or nay on Governor Cuomo's desk. I am talking, of course, about a measure that will officially allow dogs in alfresco spaces at New York restaurants. Are you psyched?
Okay, clearly the best bill of all time.
Do you have a dog?
Being real, I don't have
a dog.
You can't
be as excited as I am. I have
How dare you? Because I'm a person who loves dogs, so I want to experience other people's dogs.
Dine with us everywhere.
Because I don't have a dog.
Well, it's interesting because the truth is, if it passes, it looks like it's going to pass, but not a lot is really going to change here because, you know, as it is right now, restaurants that are kind of dog friendly to begin with will look the other way if you bring a dog with you, a well-behaved dog, to one of their outdoor spaces. And if they're dogs, they, you know, will kibosh that. And it will remain the same if the bill passes. Restaurants can choose whether or not they will allow dogs.
And
on
that's
premises.
Clutch. I mean, obviously, not everyone's going to want to have dogs in their establishments for one reason or another. That's totally fine. The fact that this bill is voluntary is, I think, the key thing that is going to make it, you know, more palatable to both restaurant owners and maybe people who aren't as jazzed as we are about dogs.
Although I have to say,
everywhere.
My own personal list of places, restaurants to visit is so long that any excuse to scratch one off the list, like if I walked up to a space with a beautiful alfresco area and I was turned away because of my dog, I'd be like, peace.
Yep,
there's
sorry.
So many restaurants that are going to allow them. I actually have Daniel and Shane, today's guests, are, you know, mic'd up right now. I'm interested to hear what you guys think because you're both, you know, you have restaurants, of course. I don't believe you have a little outdoor space at Distill, a little bit in the front, right, Shane?
Yeah.
So how do you feel about this bill?
We have a wraparound patio, and it's gorgeous, and it's definitely a highlight of dining at Distilled, especially in the summer. I think from the service element, it would be tricky with your pooches laying about.
But what about with your kids laying about? Is this not the same argument?
Yes, it's a similar one, but a little different. Your kid hopefully doesn't voluntarily defecate on the patio.
Oh my God! I don't know. We might have problems here. My dog will not defecate anywhere but where it's supposed to defecate. I don't know. I cannot
well,
say the same thing
dog,
about
then.
I do. Well, I feel like this should be an across the board rule, like for all species. If you have a well behaved species, be it dog or kid, then they should be able to go in certain spaces. And if you don't, and if they are not well behaved, then they don't belong
and
there.
And not to pile on children, because this isn't a battle about kids versus dogs, but having been in the service industry for such a long time, people's kids were always way, like, worse behaved, just because by the fact that, you know, a lot of parents are like, oh, well, you're in a place now that is enclosed, I don't have to acknowledge you anymore. I'm hoping that maybe dogs will be on leashes, or there might be something that... We should pull more kids on leashes. That's what I'm trying to get at.
I feel it.
I think that would be a wise move as well. I have a three-year-old, and sometimes I'm just like, you need to stop running around the restaurant. He has a little claim of ownership of the space, and it's just slow down. Granted, he's not defecating in the restaurant, which is a great thing, but still, you know, dogs and kids on leashes isn't the worst.
Well, I don't want this argument to get, you know, too ugly or heated before we get into the thick of things, so I'm going to move along. Something else, I think of summer. I think of beer, of course, and I do think of Corona. You know, it's an amber-colored swill. It's fun to pop a lime through the bottle, and it fizzes so beautifully. I don't drink it during any other month of the year, but when it's summer and it's hot, I find myself craving Corona, and I am certainly not alone in that, because there's actually a bit of fear. Fear has gripped the producers of Corona and Dos Equis, and that they're might be not enough demand, not enough supply to meet demand. So, Nell, are you following the Corona Gate summer 2015?
Exactly.
What do you know about it?
Well, I know that, or I discovered that Americans really, really love Corona. Way more than I ever would have imagined. I guess it's the fifth best-selling beer in the United States, which is...
Lordy,
I'm just going to leave that there. and then I guess what's happening is we love this beer so much that Corona has now had to look into a $1.5 billion expansion of their plant on the Mexican border, as well as a new plant in California that they're exploring, just to make what Beer Advocate called a beer with faded aromas of sulfur,
oh my God,
faint
nice
skunk,
quote.
And mild cooked veggies. Which, when I want a refreshing beer, I really want to think of overcooked broccoli, because that smells so good.
I would be better without that description. I just need to throw it out there. My mistake, Dos Equis is not in danger. They produce Pacifico, Negro Modelo as well. This is a Constellation brand.
Yes.
But, you know, I think it sounds like they are going to nip this one in the bud. You
your
should
Corona
have
is safe,
all
America.
The Corona you need to fill your coolers at your summer barbecue. So anyway, grab yourself a Corona. Enjoy it with your dog on a patio. We will be back in just 1 second with Daniel Eddy and Shane Lyons. You're listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network.
Has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
So I am truly excited to be joined in the studio today by two talented chefs, Daniel Eddy of Rebel, a fabulous new French restaurant and wine bar on the Bowery, and Shane Lyons of Distilled, a fantastic American-styled public house in Tribeca. And they both just so have happened, at least at one point in their lives, to be equally talented actors. I have also invited Nell Casey to keep her headphones on because, as I said before, I recently learned that just like me, she is an actor turned food writer too. Go figure. Hi there, everyone.
Hello.
You know what? I feel like we should slate, like we are on an audition or something. I have not done it in a while, but hi, I'm Sarah Zorn. I'll be your moderator today.
I forgot. forgotten about slating.
I know. It was
why
like
are you bringing
the worst.
Back these tortured memories?
It always set me off on the wrong path, saying my name like an idiot. Of course, this is exactly what I do at the top of each Taste Talk show, but I haven't gotten any better. So, Shane, I am going to start with you because while a culinary career might have seemed to have been all but laid out for you because your parents were both respected chefs with a restaurant in Colorado, you were actually quite a busy child actor. You were a regular cast member on Nickelodeon's All That. Mm-hmm. You had guest appearances on That's So Raven, The Wizards of Waverly Place, ER, Law and Order, of course, because you're not an actor without Law and Order on your resume. You were also in Cameron Crowe's Elizabeth Town. So please talk, if you would, about the genesis of your very early acting career.
Sure. I was a ham as a child. I would just love to perform, and I had so much energy constantly that my parents, at one point, my mom retold me a story that when I was seven, she had to decide whether to kill me or to let me be. And she let me be, thankfully. And in turn, that allowed me to find theater, local theater in Colorado Springs, and then eventually a short film program at Colorado College. Found an outlet for all my energy and my need to perform. And so I started to work regularly within Colorado Springs and had enough momentum that one of the short films I did went to Sundance and did quite well and was able to find representation in Los Angeles because of it.
Wow. So, Daniel, what about you? How and when did you get the acting bug, and how far did you end up pursuing it?
I got the acting bug, I don't know, I was a young kid, same sort of thing, had a lot of energy and needed an outlet. So theater always sort of was one of those things, performing, and never anything to the scale of what Shane had done, but it was just always something to passion, and it sort of grew throughout high school, doing productions through there, and ultimately led me to university and going up to Bennington, Vermont, and studying theater there.
I did a summer theater program in Bennington. I wonder if we were around there at the same time.
Could have been. Can't remember that
small
far, though.
World.
It was a while ago.
Well, it's Bennington after all. You shouldn't have been able to remember any of that.
No, which ultimately led me out of Bennington as well. it was just always that satisfaction of just, you know, doing something and knowing immediately whether it was good or it sucked. You know, there was just, it was very black and white, and I think that's something that translated very well into sort of the food, I guess. It's like, it's very transparent, you know, you either have it or you don't, you know, either you hit the mark that day or you miss it. And there's like no ifs, ands, or buts at the end of the day, and it just sort of like wraps it all up, and you're like, okay, cool, well, it was what it was, I'll do better tomorrow.
So what was then the aha moment for the both of you when you realized not so much with the acting thing, you were going to go fully into a culinary career? dun, dun, dun.
The aha moment came when my mom asked me, you know, what was I doing? She was like, what are you doing? You're not going to be an actor. And I was like, yeah, I know. But it really was her sort of giving me the aha moment, saying, go to culinary school. And I was like, wait, what? No, this is not what the plan was. And it ultimately sort of led me in that direction. You know, it was 2 years of theater and doing auditions, and kind of realized that something that I was very passionate for wasn't going to translate into happiness as a career. It was just an outlet. And it wasn't something that I want to pursue as a way to provide for my life and future family. And so that sort of brought it to a pretty abrupt halt. It was just sort of like one day I was, you know, doing stage work, and the next day it was over. And I was cool with that. You know, I still, like, loved it, and I wanted to keep it something that I love, not something that I was going to resent because I was trying to make a living off of it. So,
what about you, Shane? Because you actually had experienced a good amount of success.
Well, I was really, I had an interesting career as a kid actor in that I was always kind of on the precipice of kind of flipping over to that next level of success. I had worked and I had booked a fair amount in a short period of time. And so, you know, that's pretty important as you're establishing a career, because people want to know that you can, that you can work, and that you can work consistently, and that you're bankable. And so I was regularly screen testing on different series and pilots and films, but I was always the number two. And so after a while, that being the number two gets tiresome, especially when you're a kid. So when I was 16, I got off all that, and I started washing dishes in a restaurant in Colorado Springs with a chef who actually trained with my parents. And so it wasn't necessarily like I'm done with acting, but at that age where, you know, just the biggest challenge is asking a girl out, you know, that kind of consistent acceptance and rejection of that level of career, I was really tired of it, and I wanted something that I controlled more of my own destiny. And I think in food, you have that ability to control not everything, but you certainly don't have to listen to 40 lawyers and executives in a room tell you that you're not funny.
So, you know, the four of us actors turned food folk, it might seem like an anomaly, but the reason that I was interested in doing the show is because it so obviously isn't. Just to rattle off a few other names of former actors that I'm aware of, you have Bryce Schumann of Bettany, Michael LaMonaco of Porterhouse, Kevin Pemley of 30 Acres in Jersey City, and those are the chefs. I know other food writers and food PR people, so obviously, we cannot speak to everyone's experience, but can you guys at least theorize on what this creative connection between the two worlds is?
Yeah, well, I think that it's about what Daniel was saying. You know when you've hit it, and you know when you haven't. And that's as performers, we take in energy, and so we want a reaction from you. And I think that's the clear link, is that we're looking for a reaction. We're begging for it. We're performers. And I think the real difference that I see as I've been thinking about it is that, you know, in food, there is kind of this black and white. We as chefs want to make you feel good. We want that reaction. We don't want to make you feel bad. We want to make you feel good to great to excellent. But in performance and acting and in theater and film and TV, if you're upset, then I've done my job. If you're happy, I've done my job. And, you know, all I need is a reaction. I don't need such a specific one. And I think that's the difference, but also the similarities, is that we are begging for your reaction. It's what we feed off of.
What do you think, Daniel? Besides the fact, and somebody pointed this out to me, that a lot of actors wind up becoming servers as their day job, and maybe that is explains the bridge. I think that's a little pat. But do you have any theories about what the connection is?
No, I think, you know, Shane really sort of said it very well. You know, we're all looking for a reaction. I remember being on stage and seeing, you know, hearing the laughter or hearing, you know, just the silence. You know, you know very clearly whether you're on or not, you know. And at Rebel, we have an open kitchen, and I can look out into the dining room and see the tables, and they're happy, and I'm able to go and touch them and talk to them, and there's something that sort of brings a fulfillment of, you know, all the day's labor, all of, like, and in effect, you know, we're rehearsing every day. We're rehearsing the same task day in and day out, refining them, you know, just the cooking, you know, the execution, the pickups, the dance of service, you know. It's things that we just do over and over and over again with the aim of bringing joy to people. And so you see it go from all that day's work to the plate, to the table, and you see them take it and they just laugh and they like wiggle in their seats and you're like, okay, great, I hit it. You know, and if you don't see somebody that quite has that reaction, you know, it leaves you asking yourself, okay, what happened there? You know, where did I miss the mark with them? And sometimes it's not us. It's just somebody isn't in that mood for the day, you know. Not everyone who goes to see a comedy is in the mood to laugh, and that's something that I think that we all have to sort of understand, because, you know, in everything that we do, especially I think as actors, as cooks, as servers, we're people who take things very personally, I think, and that's also what gives us the drive to continue to do better, to continue to, like, want to do more, and it goes back again to sort of, like, wanting that satisfaction, that like that result, and knowing when you got it and when you didn't.
Now, you know, I certainly don't want to speak too much about myself and my thwarted acting career, and I'm wondering if this is maybe just the difference between food writer types and chef types, that maybe we're formerly actors, but for me, something that both unites those two creative energies for me and makes them totally disparate. It, for me, it all came down to personality, because yes, I have a lot of creativity that I want to share, but who I am, I'm much more comfortable with doing it behind a dark computer and putting it out there and people not necessarily knowing anything about me and me not being able to gauge their reactions right off and being able to express myself creatively, but in a very private way. Radio is very much the same. I am flubbing and fucking up all over the place, but nobody can see me and I feel much better about it. But I that was not going to serve me as an actor, because an actor is about being very upfront. Here I am. Love me, love me. Being able to have a sense when people don't love you at all right in front of your face, and having to pick yourself back up and brush yourself off and going out there again and saying, love me, love me, love me. I feel like there's a real love me, love me, love me unifier between food folk and actors, but the food folk get to do it, save for when they have massive open kitchens like at Rebel. But for the most part, the food folk get to do it in a very quiet, behind the scenes way. So I don't know. Do you think that it comes down a lot to personalities about, you know, what makes a person able to be an actor and what makes them more suited to a life behind the scenes?
Well, acting is a profession that you have to do with intensity in everything. And that, how you approach an audition, how you approach your sides, how you approach your script, how you approach... It's very similar to cooking in that your mise en place needs to be very tight. Always. And so that will weed out people very fast. When I meet folks who say, I'm an actor, I say, okay, well, what are you working on? What are you doing? Oh, I'm hoping to get auditions. Well, then you're not an actor. An actor works always. You know, and that, I think, when I speak very honestly to people who say, oh, I want to be an actor, and I say, well, if you're not constantly in pursuit of that, you will not succeed. Because the reality is that most people don't succeed in acting. And if you do, there's an element of it just being a fluke and lucky and you're in the right place at the right time. That's just kind of undeniable. So to even have that opportunity is rare. But if you can't back that up with pounding the pavement and being able to have your mise en place in order always, 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 you won't succeed. In my opinion, I don't think you'll succeed.
So I'm wondering how much you guys think that the rise of food television, the tremendous rise in the popularity of food television in the last, 15 to 20 years has fostered this actor-chef link. Because, 15, 20 years ago, even the most famous chefs were known primarily within the food community. They were not... they were not world-known personalities. So, and now, in order to become these tremendous brands, chefs need to be comfortable giving interviews and walking the red carpet and hosting TV shows and generally hard-selling themselves. So do you think there's any connection that has led to this actor-chef connection at all?
I'm the wrong one to ask, because I watch almost none of the shows that have to do with food on television. It's just, I've been in the kitchen, and that's where I've put all of my energy, like my whole career. So I really, and when I do have that time to watch a show on TV, the last thing it usually was to do was about food. It was like, that was my moment to sort of get away from it all, so that, I could wake up refreshed and sort of, have the excitement for the food again.
Oh, Lord knows I cannot watch food television anymore, but I'm just wondering if the promise of being able to maybe be a food star is drawing these sort of big love me personalities. But so, Shane, you competed on the next Food Network Star, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I did when I was 19, and I initially turned it down because I was at that point where I was still working as an actor. I'd graduated culinary school. I had a catering company in Los Angeles where I was actually cooking for actors and producers and getting some good write-ups. And, reality television, there's lots of reasons to dislike it. And obviously, I'm sure there's some element that's positive in there somewhere. But what I found was when I did that show, that after my first take, they cut and said, Shane, can you go back to one? And I just thought, whoa. Like, no. This is not, unless you're going to pay me, I think I said, I was 19, and I was a little, maybe a little too mouthy, but I was like, if you're going to pay me my SAG minimum wage, then yeah, I'll go back to one.
Ooh, cojones.
Well, I mean, it's, you want reality, get reality, and that's where, and I have a great relationship with Food Network now, and Susie Fogelson, and some folks over there, and so, for me, as a young, kind of fiery kid, and idealistic, as I think you probably, we all are at that age, I had a lot of objection to doing something that to me felt fake, or at least it wasn't in the moment genuine. And so at any point in time when they would ask me to, hey, can you smile again? Can you do this thing again? I would just basically say, no, I'm not going to. And that created a lot of tension. Now, was that right or wrong? I don't know. But going back to your previous question about what's the link, I think that the element of celebrity is so big within our culture, and it, and the instant celebrity is so so kind of important now because of all the different forms of media that you can expose yourself on, that there's this celebrity bubble is happening, and it's happening in all areas, and it's very apparent in food media. But what's happening is that the quality of it is well, it's two things are happening. One is the quality of the major food media is diluting. But what you see to the left and to the right of that is you're seeing some really amazing programs beginning that are counter to that reality garbage that is filling every network has their form of kitchen nightmares, MasterChef this. Like, that bubble's popping, and to the left and right of that, you're seeing things like Chef's Table on Netflix. You're seeing the work that Bourdain is doing with The Mind of a Chef, and you see all these really neat cerebral programming coming out that actually pays homage to chefs versus taking them and putting them in a cage and saying, you know, throw shit at each other and fight.
I want to see that show. I guess I've
well, we're going live on Fox in about 2 weeks, so we hope that you'll come to our first taping of Chef in a Cave
100%, I'm all over it. So, guys, how would you say that you harness your creative theatrical side at your own restaurants? Daniel, obviously you mentioned that you have a big open kitchen, which I would imagine maybe is enough to make your sous chefs or potential sous chefs pee themselves a little bit, because you are very front and center, and I would imagine that it is like giving on a show at all times and maybe editing yourself. I would assume you're not, the sense I get of you is that you're not the kind of chef that is given to like throwing tantrums and throwing knives at, you know, people's heads that work under him, but still there must be moments where you catch yourself doing something that's not necessarily, you know, made for prime time, and you have to edit yourself in the moment. I don't know. So how are you drawing on your actory smiley self at your restaurants?
Well, I throw all the knives before service starts. That's why, you know, I don't have to do it afterwards. You know, it's I get it out, you know, before the guests arrive. No, it's there. Spring restaurant where I was last cooking in Paris, you know, was an open kitchen. I also served like almost as the maitre d' a lot of the times, because the first thing that people would see when they came to the door, which you had to press a button to allow them to come in, was me. And there I was at the pass. And so if somebody wasn't there to open the door, I'd come out of the kitchen, open the door for them, greet them, you know, guide them into the dining room. And so it was 3 years of this sort of like interaction between kitchen and the guests. It was there. We ran the food. We touched the tables. We spoke to them. So one of the things that became very apparent in that time was that, you know, it's, you take a lot of people out of their element when that sort of like, when you pull back the blinds and you're like, oh, this is what we are. This is who we are. And we reveal ourselves. It changes the dynamic of the dining experience. People feel much more connected to it and become almost a part of it. And I think we have that at Rebel as well. You know, we're still very early in our life, only being 2 months old. But we, you know, we talk to the guests. You know, the guests are sitting, there's, you know, 8 seats at they'll overlook the kitchen. And, you know, the cooks there engage with them. They look up, you know, it's sort of, here we are. And there's that sense of, you could say intimacy or just a connection that helps people sort of like see that they're humans that are preparing the food for them, you know?
Shane, Distill does comfort food, but you're certainly not just, you know, throwing out chicken wings and burgers unadorned. Would you say that your, you know, super creative spins kind of play on that? They're an extension of that creative, theatrical side of you?
Well, the food at Distilled is interesting because it has no real identity. What I love about it is that I call it American Schizophrenic. Like, it just kind of dances all over the place.
Why are you not using that in your PR missives?
I don't know. I don't think my boss would like it. But to me, the menu at Distilled needs to do with several things. It needs to be approachable. The whole concept's about being approachable. We don't call it comfort food. We call it food that's approachable. And our price point in our area, we found that there was a niche for that in Tribeca, and that's what we wanted to fulfill. Simultaneously, we also have the job of being a relevant restaurant within Manhattan, and that's very challenging because, you know, if you're known for chicken wings, which, you know, we are, and thankfully because that's what pays the bills, we still have that desire to be creative and to be to put out food that hopefully our peers recognize and go, oh, that's very tasty. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel by any means, but I actually started something called eating menu at the chef's counter. So it's kind of an anti-tasting menu where you sit down, I get to know you, I've interviewed you prior to you coming in, I know what you like, I know what you don't like, and then I'm just going to cook a lot of food. We're going to see how it goes. If you don't like something that I put up, tell me, let's do something else. And I think that's the way, kind of going back with what Daniel was saying, is how I choose to connect with my guest and my creativity simultaneously. So I can feed the masses chicken wings, but then I can have four people a night where I sit down and we just cook and chat and talk and debate and play. And that's a lot of fun.
I love the element of improv. It sort of comes into that. Something. It's like you're freestyling. And, you know, I love those moments in the kitchen when, you know, you're just cooking. You just go off the menu and you're taking things and you connect with somebody there. And it's like, okay, we're just going to go on this journey together. And you are freestyling what it is. And it's a lot of times, like, in those moments of just not really overthinking or overworking the food, that some delicious things come up that you're like, well, why? How the hell did I not think about that long ago? It's so simple. It's so evident.
Because you're not thinking.
Exactly.
And that's what improv is for an actor. Yeah. Is you just play the beat, and that is really challenging to do, and that's why very few people are good at it. But when you reach a certain level of being a chef, that's the best part of cooking, is going, don't tell me anything, put me in a space, give me ingredients, and let me go.
Yeah.
And you discover that, wow, I knew so much more in this about this ingredient, or I never realized that I could use this technique in that way. And it's so freeing. It's the best way of cooking.
Oh my God, I must be your next interview, Shane. I love that idea. I want to keep this conversation going, so stay where you are, listeners too. We are going to come right back talking about theatrical restaurants. You are listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network.
This one is called Wet, Wet, Wet by Vesa. We'll be right back.
I am back with Daniel Eddy of Rebel, Shane Lyons of Distilled, and Nell Casey of Gothamist to further explore the theater of food and spotlight restaurants that go so much further than just putting food on your plate. So, guys, when I think of super theatrical food experiences, I think of places like Alinea in Chicago, for one, super well known for its theatrical edible constructs, up to 22 of them at a time. Chef Grant Achatz frequently tries to evoke all sorts of sense memories by sending out balloons made of apples and helium and sending out chopsticks, like edible chopsticks made out of cinnamon sticks. And he also changes his space, or is actually in the middle of renovating the space And he plans to actually use the restaurant as part of a tasting menu, moving guests from room to room to room. And those rooms will change throughout the year as well as the food. So when I think theatrical restaurants, that's certainly one that comes to mind. What do you guys see? What chefs, what restaurants do you see out there that you think are really, wow, razzle-dazzling them?
First of all, is this going to be like the Sleep No More of restaurants? Is that what's going to be happening? Like guests are shuttled
Alinea?
To different... Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a higher end Sleep No More. Sleep No More is certainly a good mention.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just saying, I'm like trying to imagine how that's going to work. That sounds pretty dope.
Well, they're working on it now, so the jury is
flying
out.
To Chicago,
come
y'all.
On. How else are they going to one-up themselves?
Well, I guess since I'm already chatting, I'll just start talking. First of all, Benihana, right? I mean, no, I'm just kidding.
I did not see that one coming. I think you're still in the Corona mindset.
I am. But I had a really fantastic meal a couple of months ago at Ramen Lab here in New York City. And I think that this is true for a lot of ramen-yas, is that there's this really beautiful dance and choreography that happens behind a ramen counter, especially somewhere like Ramen Lab, which is super teeny. It's at that time, it was Jack Nakamura and his apprentice who were back there. Standing room, it was like 8 or 10 stools. And there was just this elegant flow to what they were doing, and the way that they would, you know, sort of dance around one another. And then Jack had this great sort of like flip that he did with the noodles. And it was just this really visceral, like, oh, you could almost feel the noodle, the water from the noodles splattering on your face. It was just this really sort of sensory, exciting performance. And then you just got to put your face in a delicious bowl of ramen noodles at the end of it.
Not a bad
way. So, you know, not sort of in that highbrow sort of mentality, but like this just really intimate sort of experience and watching this bowl of noodles be created right in front of you. So that was really exciting. I really liked that.
Well, Shane, you're actually from the Momofuku stable, which is also well known. Momofuku Co. at least is also well known for being really avant-garde. So what restaurants or experiences have you had that you think are really above and beyond envelope pushing?
Well, I'm a cook, so I'm poor. So I don't go to these places. It would be very nice.
I'm a food writer and I'm poor, so yeah. Somebody send
me
to Alinea, please.
We'll start a not-for-profit where people pay for chefs to go out and eat at other restaurants. No, I don't know. I think I'm still kind of thinking about that idea of performance and theatrics. And if you strip everything away, what does your guest want? Your guest wants to connect, and they want to feel something, and they want to be surprised, and they want to be shocked, and they want to go wow. And so ultimately, no matter if you're at a Ramen Lab or you're at Momofuku or you're at Distilled or Rebel, you've got 3 hours to create a really intimate, really layered experience with a person, because that's what they're hoping to have. Now, whatever bells and whistles you use to do that, and your skill and technique comes through. I mean, obviously those restaurants are all fantastic and the chefs are super talented. But if you strip away the want is connectivity and intimacy. That's what people want. And I think those restaurants do a really good job at kind of pulling you close to the chest and making you feel something that might be borderline uncomfortable. Sometimes it is. But at the end, you're walking away going, wow, I was just held for like 3 hours and it was awesome. It was like good snuggling.
What do you think, Mr. Daniel? Although I have to say I had a wonderfully, not like as dramatic as, again, Alinea or Noma, which I'll just name check them. We don't need to talk about Noma. I'll put it out there. They're dramatic. There's craziness going on at Noma. But I feel like in its way, like Rebel, I had an experience there because you were there and you were connecting with me and you have these interesting little, you know, flips to your dishes that make you go, like beet with a D, bourguignon, which is its own sort of, you know, theatricality. But what restaurants have held you close to the chest for 3 hours?
You know, it's, you know, you had mentioned Alinea, and I have to, you know, also share that same thing. You know, as a cook, you're poor. You don't get to eat a lot of these restaurants, and I can't say that I have eaten at any big restaurant like that possibly ever. But what made me think, what came to mind was actually in high school, I was also another theater thing that I did was I did a lot of spoken word here in New York City, and you know, a lot of these competitions, you had a lot of people who came in with these, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 minute poems, and they'd go up on stage. And I remember my mentor at the time, you know, she said, you know, it's like if somebody goes on stage and they do an 8 minute piece, I'm going to come in with something of 30 seconds and hit the chord with that. And it's cool, like when you think about that within food, is that, like you said, you know, what people are really looking is to be, you know, feel that connection, feel something provocative. That's just, they walk out and go, wow, that just happened. And a lot of times that has happened to me with really simple and like food. You know, I think one of the most memorable experiences was actually like in Italy at this mazzeria, and it was like the simplest meal that I've ever had in my life, and it almost brought me to tears. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. Why the hell is this happening? This is zucchini. It really was that simple. And it's like, it's just, it goes back to like, what does that guest want? What are they looking for? You know, and you know, it can be a 22 course tasting menu, and it can be a 3-course meal. As long as the people who are providing the food are putting their heart and their efforts into making sure that connection occurs, then, you know, it can come in so many different forms, and, you know, they're all welcome and they're all great.
I was thinking about when you're describing that less is more mentality. In acting, if you're doing drama, and this is always the thing that I had to work on the most, is less is more. And realizing that the camera has your head in this box that is going to be, you know, 16 feet high if it's a film. And so you can't project your feelings. And it's the same with great food is very similar. And great acting is all about being subtle and playing what the very minimalist, what's there. What can I play that already exists there? And the same with food, you know, you don't need much more. If the zucchini is fantastic and the lemon is delicious and you have great salt and the olive oil is, you know, obviously of quality, that's it. And that speaks a lot to, I think, the best kind of performance, which is simple. That's what really good performance is, simple.
Guys, that was so much fun. I feel like you gave me a 40-minute argument from my mom about why she invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in an acting career for me to turn into a food writer. I feel like we need to go out and get t-shirts or something and form a club, actors turned food people, accepting submissions, additions now. Guys, that is our show for today. Be sure to visit Daniel Eddy at Rebel on the Bowery and Shane Lyons at Distilled in Tribeca. You could also follow them on Twitter at Rebel NYC or Distilled New York NY, that is. Nell Casey is easily enough at Nell Casey, and I'm a little more complicated at Sarah Zorn BK. You could follow Taste Talks at Taste Talks, of course, and be sure to subscribe to our show feed on iTunes or Stitcher. Until next time, you have been listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.